Today, I want to talk about environmental racism. And I want to talk about the Roanoke branch of the NAACP, the Roanoke, Virginia branch of the NAACP, and its struggles to close the dump in Booker T. Washington Park in the heart of Black Roanoke. The NAACP in Roanoke was led by a World War II veteran and also the pastor of Hill Street Baptist Church. His name was Reverend Raymond R. Wilkinson. Now, a little background. So today, as I begin to recast the NAACP's legacy by examining the role that a local branch, the Roanoke branch, played in the struggle against environmental racism, my talk makes several historiographic interventions. Number one, far too frequently, scholars divorce environmentalism from what we call the classical phase of the civil rights movement. The work of Christopher Foreman, author of Promise and Peril of Environmental Justice, exemplifies this tendency in the scholarship. His book opens, "Americans overwhelmingly deplore both racial discrimination and environmental degradation." But until recently, these concerns seldom directly intersect in public policy discourse. Throughout the 1960s and 1970s, environmentalists attended to an agenda far removed from racial minorities and the poor. Although many of them actively supported the struggle of ethnic minorities and African Americans in particular, environmentalism and civil rights / social welfare evolved as distinct issue spheres, each with its own statutory framework, institution, and audiences. In other words, environmentalism isn't for Black folks during the civil rights movement. On the other hand, scholars often limit the environmental justice movement to a postscript of the civil rights movement. Most of the literature on the start of the environmental justice movement starts in the late 1970s or the early 1980s. We can look at Beam versus Southwestern Waste Management Corporation in 1979, where Black Houstonians filed a class action lawsuit to challenge the siting of a waste facility in their neighborhood. Other scholarship starts in 1982 when more than 500 people are arrested in Warren County, North Carolina as they protest the dumping of PCBs in their local communities. This campaign is led by Reverend Ben Chavis, who later becomes the executive director of the NAACP. But by locating the origins of the struggle against environmental racism in the late 1970s or the early 1980s, this body of scholarship overlooks civil rights organizations like the Roanoke NAACP, who were actively involved in environmentalism during the, quote, classical phase of the civil rights movement. Moreover, anecdotally, even if we are not even thinking empirically, if we're thinking anecdotally, we know that African Americans are disproportionately targeted for siting of hazardous waste. There are hundreds of thousands of NAACP members in the 1960s. There are well over 1,000 chapters of the NAACP across the country. African Americans were simply passive recipients of Jim Crow environmentalism? No. This is counterintuitive. And so what we need to do is to offer local studies like Roanoke to challenge these gaping holes in civil rights historiography and to recast the NAACP's legacy. Second, I want to use the Roanoke NAACP spike to close Washington Park. The Washington Park dump is an avenue to highlight the myriad shortcomings and how we choose to characterize the NAACP and how we think about civil rights historiography writ large. We think about the NAACP and the civil rights movement as when the Cold War hits, they forget about labor. They turn to non-economic objectives. But in Roanoke, as activists call for a closing of the Washington Park dump, they also challenged employment discrimination in the city sanitation department. Moreover, the Roanoke NAACP believed that the Washington Park dump undermined public health and limited local school children's ability to learn, to play, and to thrive. In other words, in Roanoke, closing the Washington Park dump operated as a trope that embraced deep concerns of environmentalism, the welfare of labor, public health, educational equity, and children's rights. Third, my discussion today will underscore the notion that ordinary people can do extraordinary things. An historic moment where the term environmental racism had not even been coined. And these federal laws that we often think about with environmentalism, the National Environmental Policy Act of 1969, the Clean Air Act of 1970, the Federal Water Pollution Control Act of 72, or even Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the wrong NAACP's extra-legal activism proved to be the key in closing the Washington Park Dome. As Professor Walter said, we often think about the NAACP first as a legalistic organization. The NAACP during this period, to be sure, is trying to give meaning to Brown. It's trying to defend the First Amendment rights of civil rights activists participating in direct action. Yet, the Roanoke NAACP struggle against environmental racism, led primarily by non-lawyers and whose ranks were comprised of people who couldn't vote a city councilman out of office, who couldn't vote a mayor out of office because they were disenfranchised by the poll tax in the early 1960s. They used the threat of extra-legal activism to transform municipal policy and advance the cause of environmentalism. As author Charles Payne reminds us, if we're surprised at what those people accomplished during the Civil Rights Movement, our surprise may be more of a commentary on us than on them. The last thing that I want to do today is think about the organizational structure and behavior of the NAACP. I want us to reconsider the NAACP's national structure and understand how the structure facilitates democratic discourse, local leadership, and attention to local needs. So the story of closing the Washington Park Dome starts in 1938 when the city of Roanoke purchases an incinerator to burn trash for $100,000. Yet by the late 1940s, the city incinerator was only burning about two-thirds of the 200 tons of trash every day produced by Roanokeans. The city had failed to develop a comprehensive waste disposal plan that could adequately deal with Roanoke's population explosion during the 1940s. From 1930 to 1940, Roanoke only has a net gain of 81 residents. But from 1940 to 1950, Roanoke gains more than 20,000 new residents, much of it through annexation, as the city goes from 10.26 square miles to 26.18 square miles. Moreover, after World War II, consumption patterns change. People are more affluent. They're buying new things. This means there's more trash. Lastly, after the New Deal, Americans are asking different questions about how do we engage government. They're asking, what sort of services can government provide to me? And so the number of trash pickups weekly doubled in many areas of Roanoke. So in 1947, with Roanoke unable to deal with incinerators, the city begins to dump part of its solid waste in an abandoned quarry, an environmental hazard in its own right, in Roanoke's only African-American park. Washington Park. Washington Park occupied a sort of sacrosanct space in Black Roanoke life. It hosted Negro League baseball games, 4th of July celebrations, cookouts. There was a small creek going through called Lick Run, and children played in the creek and they fished in the creek. Washington Park eventually became home to the Royal Garden, a place to unwind with good food, dancing, and evening entertainment. In 1949, local residents mobilized and petitioned Roanoke City Council to close the dump. During what the council calls a, quote, gripe session, Black citizens asserted that the dump was a sanitary menace and complained of the flies that quickly bred on those steamy July days. The open-air landfill eventually was infested by the carcasses of dead dogs, dead cats, pigs, goats, mosquitoes growing in standing water, contaminated liquids leaching in the groundwater, hordes of rats feasting on decomposing garbage. On many days, this noxious smell would move local residents from their front porches into their houses. The city stated that the dump would stay open, but they would spray occasionally to deal with the mosquitoes. Yet despite these air, soil, and water hazards, in 1952, the city develops its first housing project for African Americans, Lincoln Terrace Housing Project. The same year, it also constructs a new Lucy Addison High School. It opens Booker T. Washington Junior High School. And in 1958, they opened Lincoln Terrace Elementary School. There are 2,000 kids who are going to school in this area, only steps away from a dump. More than 7,000 black Roanokers live in this area. An entire community is burdened, as the dump is only an eye shot from the city's black hospital, the black YMCA, the black YWCA, and several local churches. Black Roanokers, even in their deathbed, had to deal with the dump, as the dump was just a couple paces away from Springwood Burial Park, the segregated cemetery. In 1953, the Black Parent Teacher Association complains. The city does nothing. 1954, the Black PTA complains. There are no changes. The dump is beginning to bloom. The dump is designed to be 700 feet long, 150 feet wide, and 73 feet deep. In 1955, the city manager, Arthur Owens, says that there's only 3 to 6 months left in this dump. In this two-year period that Roanokers are complaining, there are 23 fires in which the fire department is dispatched. 23 fires in 2 years. Each fire takes an average of more than 3 hours to extinguish because of the methane gas that is seeping into the soil. 1956, there are promises to actually close the dump. 2 years. In 2 years, the city council says that we'll close the dump. But 1961 rolls around. 5 years later, the dump is still open. The city council says, well, it's close to full. It's not quite full yet. And so they promise to end the dump and transform this park area into one of the finest parks in the entire region. 1962, city council decides to study the situation and propose methods of solving the entire garbage disposal program. 1 month later, after the city council meeting in September of 1962, the city manager, Arthur Owens, hasn't even looked at the engineer's report to study the problem. Council, led by new mayor Murray Stoller, agrees that the dump situation is critical and that it will reach capacity again, in another year. This is 7 years after the city initially said that the dump needs to be closed in 3 to 6 months. By 1962, there is widespread agreement that the dump is obnoxious and should be closed. The mayor agrees on it, but they're debating about this incinerator. Do we repair this incinerator that's aging, or do we replace the incinerator? Where does the money come from? There's a Council on Human Relations, a biracial committee of prominent ministers, lawyers, doctors, businessmen, who quietly desegregate Roanoke. They're up in arms about the dump. This group includes the NAACP's Reverend Wilkinson. The Roanoke World News, known for its deeply conservative views, agrees that the dump should be closed. The Roanoke World News calls Martin Luther King a professional agitator. They say that the 14th Amendment was never legally adopted because it was adopted during Reconstruction. These aren't bleeding hearts. They're saying that this dump needs to be closed. By mid-January in 1963, Mayor Stoller says, I'll set a date. June 1st, 1963, the dump will be closed. The newspaper says it's impossible for this to be done. Only 2 weeks later, council takes a step back. They call for more studies, more time. This has been going on for more than a decade. And so Reverend Wilkinson stands up in council, and he scolds council for having a mind of inaction. He argues that as council is considering closing the dump, they need to repair the city incinerator and end employment discrimination within the sanitation department. African-American truck drivers at the incinerator have lost their jobs as retaliation and have been replaced by inexperienced white truck drivers. April 22, 1963, Mayor Stoller takes another step back. He doubts that this June 1, 1963 deadline can be met. The time has not arrived, Stoller says, when bids can be put in. And so April 30, 1963, they set a new deadline, another year, February 1964. And so the NAACP in Roanoke is frustrated with this delay, and they begin to branch off from this biracial committee and formulate their own actions. The NAACP begins to think about ways to attack the dump. I asked A. Byron Smith, who is now 90 years old, who had participated in this, why not courts? The NAACP is a legalistic organization. And he said, the courts? Who are we going to appeal to? Brown had been decided a decade ago. We're frustrated with the courts. We're spending a lot of money and time in the courts. So consequently, black lawmakers look to extra-legal engagement to change municipal policy. Reverend Wilkinson had a keen understanding of how power worked in Nome. Roanoke was deeply invested in this racially moderate image. The local newspapers often praised Roanokeers for desegregating, not in the way that Greensboro had desegregated, or not in the ways in which Danville was desegregated, and definitely not Birmingham. Roanoke is continually in a self-congratulatory pose that praises itself for its commitment to order and peace, quote, between the races. In 1963, word leaks out that Reverend Wilkinson, through another Reverend, Reverend James Allison, that the NAACP is going to lead Birmingham-style protests to close this dump once and for all. And it was true. The NAACP was organizing a mass rally, Free in 63, in which they were going to teach people direct action techniques. The rumor was that Wilkinson was going to line up women with baby carriages, to block bulldozers from dumping in Washington Park. We know about the Children's Crusade, and we know about these iconic images. The rumor was that, and Wilkinson never confirmed or denied this, but it was reported widely in the newspaper and talked about at city council, that they would use what had been done in Birmingham and Roanoke and not only create national attention, but international attention. As the OAU is meeting in August in 1963, Birmingham is going on. These images are transmitted, and so this fight for the hearts and minds of the third world is shaping national politics and international politics. Reverend Wilkinson is appealing to this internationalist idea of social change by invoking Birmingham. This struck heart in the fears of Roanokeers who praise themselves for moderation. They asked Reverend Wilkinson for calm because it could generate negative national attention and international attention. Mayor Stoller, in the face of Birmingham-style protests, agreed to close the dump on June 1st. This was a monumental moment for Black Roanoke. The clips, if you look at on the news, they're singing the song "Certainly, Lord." Have you got your religion? Certainly, Lord. And then they say, "Are you ready to close the dump?" And the crowd and congregation erupts. Certainly, Lord. Passion about environmental politics during the classical phase of the civil rights movement. But the NAACP struggle against environmental racism wasn't a full victory. Methane fires continued to thrive even after they closed the dump. There was a spark in the years following because the ground had been polluted in such a way, fires would erupt. There remains a bacterial load in this creek that kids used to play in and still play in. And the dump was relocated to a working class white area in the city. They make a sanitary landfill instead of an open dump, but still raising questions about environmentalism. So how do we think about the NAACP in this very short time? In a space in which Thurgood Marshall isn't litigating, or Roy Wilkins isn't making calls, local people control local branches and develop local leadership. They are able to bend a national organization to the needs of Roanoke and its communities. This is democracy in action. This is democracy in action. Local people can lead their own protests. Democracy in action. There are no state or national resolutions in 62 or 63 about environmental racism, as much as I can determine. the fact that the Roanoke NAACP can craft its own agenda within this desegregation imperative, critically important. But at the same time, the NAACP is a membership organization, unlike SNCC, unlike the SCLC. And someone can take advantage, if they want to, of the state NAACP branch or the national NAACP branch. They can be elected and go through these systems. Again, democracy. And so when we begin to think about the NAACP, we have to think about a robust idea of what democracy means. The challenge for us is to begin to think about environmental histories and the civil rights movement. Our scholarly existence depends on these stories of communities of color without the Roanoke NAACP, in which my father was a member, and my mother desegregated schools. I wouldn't be here. We need more of these local histories. We need histories that are accessible for local people. But I'm confident that Woodson and the other research institutions across the country can close these gaps in historiography. Thank you, and have a good day.